Thank you, Ajahn, for being here. So some of you may have met Ajahn for the first time a couple of weeks ago when he gave a public talk on loving kindness practice, metta practice. And then he went up the Arrow River and helped Ajahn Sunadamo start building their new library. A couple community members went up. Really fortunate to have him back. He's going to be teaching in Madison, I think maybe Tuesday, and then on to visit his parents, and then back eventually to Ubayagiri, where he's a resident monk there with a number of other monks at this wonderful monastery in Northern California. And Ajahn's been to Kamagan a number of times and really appreciate that he's been committed to our community. It's really nice to have a connection with this ancient and still vibrant tradition of men and women committing to the monastic lifestyle and developing the practice in the way the Buddha taught that it really works well. So it's good to have these examples, even in Minneapolis. Thank you so much, Ajahn, for being here. So if you didn't hear, today we're Ajahn, in fact, I asked Ajahn to present on this because a number of community members had talked to me about devotional practices and its role. And you know, we don't do a lot of formal devotional practice at the center, but we all are devotional beings, whether we know it or not. We have this part of our heart that wants to sort of love and kind of celebrate. And we use objects and rituals and various forms to facilitate that heart energy. And it really brings a lot of energy, aliveness into our spiritual life, which might otherwise be kind of dry. So it's good for us to explore how this may make sense. And that's why I asked Ajahn to present on this subject. You know, as lay people who aren't so tied in the traditional Buddhist form, you know, we're interested in meditation, we may be very serious practitioners even, but we're not so enveloped by the traditional Buddhist form, being out here in the plains. So it's nice to see, because one of the things that happens when you're ordained, like Ajahn Dzogchenpa has, is you're immediately embedded in these ancient forms, and either you make them come alive in one way or another, or you probably feel oppressed by them. So I'm hoping we hear a little bit about Ajahn's own work with the form of, you know, the monastic form, which is very, I don't know, regimen is the right word, but there's just a lot to it, and sort of kind of owning that form and how that's been and how it can be a cause for energy instead of something you have to do. Looking forward to that.
How do you get
here?
So I thought how we could start off the afternoon would be to actually do a puja. That's what the devotional practice, what we call every day at the monastery, we call two pujas. So in the morning, we usually gather about an hour before sunrise, and the whole community gets together, and we do chanting, and sit for usually about an hour, hour and 10 minutes. And then do a little more chanting. And then occasionally there'll be a down talk at other periods. And then in the evening we'll do the same thing, do some chanting and meditation together. And so that would be, there are forms and rituals to that. So it's like the community all gathering together in silence. And then when the senior monk arrives, then everybody sort of gets up on their heels and puts their hands in Anjali. And the senior monk, after he's bowed three times, and they light the candles and the incense, and the whole community sort of bows together at the same time in unison. It's sort of kind of a beautiful sort of affirmation from everybody that we're still on the same page, even though we all have different agendas or different views about, you know, practice and things like this. It's just sort of a coming together of the community. And then they will do, usually it's the, what I thought we'd do tonight, or this evening, would be the evening chanting in English. So maybe I'll come back next year and we'll do the exam course. We'll do it in Pali. We'll start off with English this year. And then we won't even do the entire section of it. But I thought we could do, I will light the candle. I won't light the incense. I know some people are allergic to it. But what I like doing is taking the incense. I'm personally allergic to incense myself. So. I don't burn it in my own cabin when I'm meditating, but I usually will just take the stick and just sort of like, you know, say to myself, like wandering this, you know, to the Buddha or the Dhamma Sangha, and I stop thinking in the incense holder, but I won't burn it. So it's still a nice sort of gesture to do. And then do some chanting and then meditate. So the chanting will start off with on page 17. And I thought what we would do is go through just the initial first section, which is called the dedication of offerings. And then we'll do the preliminary homage. And then this is called the recollection of the Buddha and the supreme praise of the Buddha. And then it goes into recollection of the Dhamma, supreme praise of the Dhamma. So we'll just do the recollection of the Buddha and then skip the second part and do recollection of the Dhamma, skip the next part and do recollection of the Sangha. So, and I would just pay attention, like this time as you're doing it, you know, there's a lot of the elements of it that you may not understand. You may not understand the wording. We have probably explained a little bit already, so some of it makes sense. But part of the mastic training is just getting comfortable with not knowing. So it's sort of suspending judgment, putting yourself into a form and just seeing what happens. So sometimes it is aversion, sometimes it is negative mind states come up, or just confusion. Like, why are we doing that? What does that mean? And so, you know, it's good to see that in ourselves. It's like, where our mental states are. And then, from that, also paying attention to the questions, and then that will, allow you an entry into sort of the inquiry, and sort of that's how investigation starts. So when you have those questions, pay attention to them. Okay, what is that? So that's not something we should push away. It's not something to feel bad about. I don't know what this is about, so I'm not going to do it. This is an opportunity to learn. That's one way to look at it. And then, so we'll do it. And just sort of pay attention to how you feel. You may not have any emotions. It might make you feel very happy to do it as well. And so pay attention to that and know, or sort of figure out why. And then what I thought we'd do after we do sort of the chanting and meditate for maybe 15, 20 minutes, then I'll sort of walk through all the various elements of sort of like the shrine, talk about the bowing, and to give you a little more explanation of what you had just done. A lot of people feel like, well, I won't do it until I understand it. So that's a very Western sort of attitude. It's very common in the monastic form for that to happen. So, the monks and nuns will get there and, I'm not going to do it until you tell me exactly why I'm doing it, So they usually don't get the answers, so they have to sort of plug in. It's something you slowly learn over time. So I'm going to give it to you, the monastic sort of training, but we'll just start in and do it. And then sort of explain things. And then after the sit, when I start explaining things, I really want it to be sort of open. Like as I'm explaining things, if other questions come up, I really want it to be more interactive instead of me just sort of, explaining what I think these things mean. So if it brings up other questions for you, or just have practices at home, or things like that, I really want it to be for you, understanding, and so I really open it up for questions at that point. So the first part, we'll have to explain a little bit before we start. But traditionally, when I will turn around to light the candle, was everybody will also rise up. And if you don't feel comfortable with this, you don't have to. For men in particular, we actually sit on our heels. You can see me with this in front, but sitting in this posture. And then I'll light the candles and then just bow three times from here. And women, it's okay to sit on your heels. Bow three times. 17. Now the part that's in parentheses, that'll be the part that I chant. And then mark the part that's in square brackets, mm-hmm. then you can chant those parts. And then everybody comes in after Mark and chants the part. So the first part you do is plenary homage to the Buddha, mm-hmm. where it says homage. That just sounds weird.
Good.
It says homage to the Buddha. The first parentheses I do is second one. To the Blessed One, the Lord who fully attains perfect enlightenment, to the teaching which He expounded so well, and to the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, to thee, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, we render with offerings our rightful homage. It is well for us that the Blessed One, having attained liberation, still has compassion for later generations. May these simple offerings be accepted for our long-lasting benefit and for the happiness it gives us. The Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed One, I render homage to the Buddha, the Blessed One. The teaching, so completely explained by Him, I bow to the Dhamma. The Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, I bow to the Dhamma. Now let us pay preliminary homage to the Buddha.
Homage to the Blessed,
Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Homage to the Blessed, Noble and Perfectly Enlightened One. Now let us chant the recollection of the Buddha.
A good word
of the Blessed One's reputation has been spread as follows. He, the Blessed One, is indeed the pure One, the perfectly enlightened One. He is impeccable in conduct and understanding, the accomplished One, the knower of the world. He trains perfectly those who wish to be trained. He is teacher of gods and humans. He is awake and holy.
So the bottom of the page.
Now let us chant the recollection of the Dhamma.
The Dhamma
is well expounded by the Blessed One. Apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inward to be experienced individually by the wise. Now let us chant the recollection of the Sangha.
They are the Blessed One's disciples
who have practiced well, who have practiced directly, who have practiced insightfully, those who practice with integrity. That is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. These are the Blessed One's disciples. Such ones are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offering, worthy of respect. They give occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world.
Okay, just now, 15 to 20 minutes.
since this is a workshop on devotion, I thought I might just do a little guided meditation. If you have a meditation that you like doing, you don't want to just follow along with it, that's fine. So if you just want to focus on the breath, or if you're doing meditation or something like that, that's fine. But just go ahead and close your eyes. Just feel comfortable in your body. Make any adjustments you need to be able to sit still for about 15-20 minutes. Just become aware of your breathing. I like doing this meditation every once in a while, where I just imagine that I'm living during the time of the Buddha. I might be living in one of the monasteries where the Buddha is living. So it's tropics, probably in a very secluded forest. And this particular monastery we'll be at, we each have our own individual little cabin. Probably it's made out of bamboo and grass thatched roof, just big enough to meditate and keep our few belongings inside. It's early evening. The sun is just sort of starting to set. In the tropics, the sun sets very quickly, so it's getting dark very quickly. Probably lots of cicadas, loud insects are starting to come out and making noise. The heat of the day is starting to dissipate. It's a nice time to be outside, just on the porch of your little cabin meditating. As we're sitting there on our little porch, you might notice all the other cabins that are nearby, that many people have little candles burning in front of them, protected under our little mosquito nets. There's a sense that everybody in the monastery is really practicing, putting forth a lot of effort into their meditation practice. It's really inspiring to see. Just knowing that group practice can really be a benefit. A few people in the community are out doing walking meditation. They might have two or three candles burning on their meditation path, one on each end and one in the center, just so they don't step on any insects, so they don't harm anybody, any beings. People in the community are starting to walk towards where the sound of the bell was coming from. So we get up from our meditation and take our candle and start walking towards the meditation hall. is silently moving through the forest. Nobody's talking to anybody. Everybody's moving in silence. Not in a big rush. Not going slowly. As we near the meditation hall, it's a fairly large building. It has open sides on it, so there's a nice breeze going through. Kind of surprising to see there's already a couple hundred people there. So you go and find a spot that's appropriate for you to be sitting. We're kind of all in rows, sort of facing the front. And again, it's very noticeable that there's a couple hundred people here, but hardly any noise is being made. Everybody sort of comes in harmony and is practicing in harmony. Out of the corner of our eye, we notice a monk walking in, and he's heading up to the very front of the meditation hall, and we realize it's Venerable Ananda. He's got sitting cloth and a glass of water, and he's setting it out, and he's setting it out for the Buddha. You kind of get excited because, well, the Buddha's going to, sometimes he comes to the he included to give talks. He's probably going to be coming. Start looking around, start noticing, wow, there's Mahamudgalana, Sariputta up front. I hadn't noticed that. Dharmadina, the senior nun, is over, sitting there up front too, and just feeling the preciousness of the Sangha. After a few minutes, actually the Buddha comes in. You see him very graciously. Very smooth, beautiful etiquette. Just walking calmly up to the front of the room, sitting down. Folding his legs crosswise. And there we are, meditating with the Buddha. thing, so not to explain what we just did. I guess more like a formal puja like we do in the monasteries is I was looking at just, I think there's sort of three aspects that I'd like to sort of talk about more, say formally, would be the first part of it is the bowing. Bowing aspect, I don't know if this is the order I'll go into, bowing, the chanting, and then also actually just the physical elements of the shrine, and sort of the significance of that. And, so maybe I'll start off with the shrine, and so this is a very beautiful, it's interesting if you look at sort of different traditions, sorry for putting it back there.
So you can have it to the mouth today. I'm
trying to move my ear and all that. Can you hear that? Okay. So the first thing, I guess, is noticing when I look at a shrine is actually the Buddha image itself. So this particular image is a smaller version of the Buddha image we have at Abhayagiri, the monastery where I ordained. I think we Ajahn in the community, and she gave us two common grounds. Way for us to feel closer to you, and hopefully for you to feel closer to the monastic communities as well. And so, I guess one thing to understand about a Buddha image is that it's actually not supposed to be a physical representation of Gautama Buddha. So, if you look at the different traditions, like Chinese Buddhas or Japanese Buddhas, or this came from Borobudur. In Indonesia, so this is an Indonesian Buddha image, and so the phases tend to take on over the centuries, sort of take on the folk of the people from that particular region or century, and so it's not trying to be a statue of Buddha, a physical representation of the actual Buddha, Gautama Buddha. So it's more of an image of the word Buddha itself. Actually means to be awake. So this is a symbol of being awake, and then also all of the other the qualities that we attribute towards Buddhism or Buddha. So compassion, any wisdom, any of the teachings, just the fact that the Buddhist teachings are available and that they do lead to enlightenment. So it's like all these sort of positive qualities we associate with Buddhism, the ones I mentioned in others as well. So it's supposed to be a physical manifestation of that. And most Buddha images will at the very bottom have a lotus flower. So people think their heart and stuff like that, but they're usually it's a lotus flower. And so it's like the Buddha sitting on the lotus. And the lotus flower, in terms of like offering and things like that, especially in Thailand, that's sort of the main sort of flower that's offered, and it has the symbology of that sort of some of the lotuses will bloom underneath the water, and some will bloom on the water, and some bloom above the water, and so it's sort of like three different stages, and that sort of the highest would be the one comes out of the water and isn't affected by that, and then there's other people who are still sort of stuck in the mud. Still below the water, but they're still good wholesome qualities, and you're blooming, you're practicing, and some people rise to the surface, and then this particular aspect of the lotus flower is that even though it's in the water, it's like the water doesn't affect it, sort of it sheds the water very easily, and the lotus flowers that come above be like somebody who's realized enlightenment. So it's a part of the symbology of the flowers across the bottom. And you probably noticed with the different Buddha images, they all have their hands in different postures. So like this posture here is called the Abhaya, which means fearless. And my joke used to be at the monastery, Ajahn Amaro, the co-abbot of the monastery, so I, you know, telling people just being, you know, the Abhaya mudra and stuff like that. And I corrected him one day and said that if you ever ordained in a monastery in our tradition, Ajahn Chah lady, it's just we request that you ordain for 5 years for the training. It really takes about 5 years to sort of figure out sort of how all the etiquette and all the rules and 5 years of the senior monks, you know, having to put in training, and so that they really request that people, if they want to ordain, that they at least sort of make a commitment for 5 years. So I always said, this is the Abhaya Giri Mudra saying, if you want to ordain, it's 5 years. So if you come to Common Ground for a day of meditation, you just give yourself 5 years. That's what the Buddha is telling you, 5 years. Give yourself time. So, but there are other mudras. There's my favorite mudra is the Dhammacakka Mudra. And there's different meanings of these. But there's also the sort of meditating Buddha, which just has his hands in his lap. There's the most common one, the most famous one is where I think it's his right hand on his knee and he's touching the ground. So that represents the moment of his enlightenment. So he's calling on Mara comes and challenges him. So he's the personification of sort of evil, or it's not quite the same as the devil, the Mara, but he's similar. And so on the night of enlightenment, the Mara comes and challenges the Buddha and says, you know, what right do you have to sit there? And he tried everything else, and nothing else worked, and so he tries to, what right do you have to sit there and try to become enlightened? And the Buddha reflects on all of the bharati, you know, the 10 perfections that he's developed, and all the wholesomeness he's done over the many millions of years, and he's been practicing them, and he calls on Mother Earth, which is really significant. It's like it's not just sort of the I of the right, or just sort of, you know, sort of personal. He's calling on, you know, nature and Mother Earth. He's touching the earth and says, you know, I call on Mother Earth to bear witness to my, you know, the effort that he's put forward. And it says that Mother Earth causes, she wrung out our hair and caused a flood and made Mars and his army sort of receive. So that's a really beautiful Buddha image of he's touching the earth. So I like that. It's the symbology of, yeah, just sort of realizing we're, you know, we can call on other people for help. Beautiful image. It's like the 5 years. But then the Dhammacakka, I really love that. The Dhammacakka was the very first sermon that the Buddha presented, and the first five ascetics. Kandanya, one of the monks who was there, actually sort of understood what he was talking about. He became a stream etcher. So that was what they called the turning of the wheel. That was when the Buddhism really, you know, once there was the Buddha there, but then once he actually presented the teachings and somebody understood, then he's like, okay, it's going to work. And then, so the representation exists. The way I take it to be is that it's the teachings of dependent origination. There's the 12 step link, and it sort of starts with ignorance and it comes back to death and starts back over, ignorance and death all over again. But at the midpoint of that, there's where you get into feeling, and then is it craving, or I won't touch on this. At a certain point, about the midpoint, there's if you can catch sort of dependent origination, sort of that feeling is sort of like it's like pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So that's going to come up no matter what, once you sort of around the circle, like you can't prevent sort of those sort of sensations, those sort of perceptions coming up. But then it comes into, you know, say, clinging and grasping. And if you can catch it at that point, then you don't go on to the depth of ignorance. You can get off the circle at that point. So that's what I think the thing is coming up here. And then another is called transcendent dependent origination, which is another one which starts at suffering, and then leads to this other causal link that kind of comes back to liberation. So it's a sort of ability to break that and go up to higher. And I think this is like the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But I don't know if that's true or not. So all of these different hand signals do have different representations. And, you know, like if you have a particular teaching that you actually like or enjoy or something like that, you know, it can be that you know, to find a moon image and sort of it might actually sort of represent a particular type of meditation or what you're aspiring towards. Or if it's just have an image that you just like the beauty of it, that's good enough as well. So this is obviously a seated Buddha, but you also find reclining Buddhas, where he's somebody happy his head on a pillow or on his arm, he's reclining, laying down on his right side. There would be standing Buddhas, and then the walking Buddhas as well. And so my favorite Buddha image is one in Thailand. It's I think it's like 100 feet tall. It's just a really beautiful image. And it's kind of interesting because they made copies of it, that are smaller, maybe like 6 feet tall, things like that. And they don't work when they're 6 feet tall because the image, the size, the proportions is, you're looking at a 100 foot tall image, so like the top has to be wider than the bottom and things like that. So they always make the copies the exact rendition of it. They don't work with the big images, which is really impressive. So that's one of my favorite images, is the standing or walking Buddha image. And I think not have a couple of standing and walking images there, but they're not as common. But there are lots of, in Thailand, there are lots of temples that actually have lying down Buddha images, so they're fairly common there, and in Burma. That's quite common. So that's the central aspect of the shrine is the Buddha image. And sometimes it'll even raised higher, so it's like not on the same sort of level as all the other like the flowers and incense will be raised up, but then they start getting, the shrine starts getting complicated, and I think most Westerners sort of like the simple, really clean look which the shrine has. So then the three elements that sort of we add to it would be the candle, the flowers, and the incense. And the candle, most shrines I think we use like the taper candles, so the dinner candles. You have two, one on either side. I never thought about this, but I wonder if that could sort of represent Sariputta Moggallana, sort of the two chief disciples on either side of the Buddha. So we just have Ananda here today. So Moggallana, they're all teaching someplace else. We have candle, the wisdom of Ananda, actually the wisdom of the Buddha. So that's the light, sort of the bringing of light into the darkness. So it just represents the wisdom aspect. Then the flowers, they actually represent impermanence. So we put them out, and we can see this one here is very healthy and alive. This one's starting to go already. These flowers down here, in a couple of days, though, if we just left them there, they're going to be... If you're up here, you can see there's actually a few little... And they've already fallen off. So direct very quickly, showing its impermanence. So like, all of us are aging and slowly going to be dying, passing away. But it could happen over another year, another 20 years, 50 years. So it's going to happen slowly. With the flowers, you cut them within the earth, it'll happen in a week. So it's a good reminder. Note that, pay attention to that. So, the flowers are representing impermanence. And then the incense is, if we had burnt it, we would notice the fragrance and the sweet smell of it. And that's the sweet smell of morality, the practice of sila. They say that somebody who is perfect in sila, it's like they can just have this vibration around them, or it's just a... people are attracted to that kind of person, so it's sweet and attractive. So the incense represents that. It also represents when you burn it, you just have a little glow. Just where it's burning, and that can also represent the samadhi practice, one focusing of the mind. People who are practicing, say jhana practice, things like that, they can represent that. Another version I've heard of, which I've never heard talked about in any of our our traditions, but I liked it, was the representing of the candle, flowers, and incense. And then many shrines will have like we might have water inside the water vessel, but like probably in more of the Tibetan tradition and maybe the Mahayana tradition, you also will put fruit or food on the shrine. And especially in those situations, it would be like be representing the four elements. So the fire, obviously the candle, the air element would be the incense, the flowers would be the earth element, and then the water, of course, would be water. So I like that sort of imagery, earth, water, fire, and air. Do you know what's in that?
Yeah, Neil Tamen, I forget his monastic
name.
Yeah. Brought that. It's from the ashes of the pyre of Ajahn Chah's funeral.
Okay.
Searches a little bit of the ashes.
Yeah, so many, many shrines you will find. Okay, so you'll find these little, reliquaries, what they call them. And sometimes they'll have called the Buddha relics, crystals, or sometimes they're little balls. They're all different colors and shapes and sizes. And they will be if a master, either a nun or a monk, has passed away, that they've reached enlightenment. When they're cremated, most times their body is washing the crystals behind. And then they collect them up and pass them out to their disciples and our people have been to support the monastery. So yeah, this is from Ajahn Chah, and when he passed away and had cremation, his body and then turned into crystals. And they had a big, if you go to the monastery, they have a big shrine and kind of stupa for that. You can go in and see them. But also too, they'll collect do the cremation. They collect all the ashes and everything that were in the fire as well, and then pass those around as well. So I think everyone who was ordained in the Ajahn Chah lineage got some of this. So when Neil presented that to the community here, so yeah, sometimes you will see those. It's kind of hard to know, exactly. Maybe the person who has it, would know if they were Buddha relics or if they were some enlightened master, with what they were. It's very common to find a reliquary like that. I guess the other element of the shrine is the height of it. And so this is a very good height. It's like I've heard that it's good to have if you're sitting on the ground, you should just a little bit looking up to the Buddha, so that you don't have it. If all you have at your house is, a low table like this or something like that, that's absolutely fine. It's not like you have to do something like this. This is an ideal kind of situation. You have the shrine, when you're sitting down, you're looking up to it slightly. Also, too, if you have a room in your house that is your particular meditation room, if you can arrange it so as you come into the room, it's the first thing you see. So if here, if you come in, the shrine on that back wall, your focus is, when you come in here, your focus is right to the center of the shrine, so sort of your focus is on the Buddha or just being awake. So it's a nice reminder. So when we build our cabins in the monastery, we try to do that, try to figure out how to put the shrine in, leading your eyes right to it. Also, too, you'll notice that there isn't anything else on here that's sort of worldly, so it's Mark isn't putting his National Geographic magazines or Sports Illustrated magazines up here, stuff like that. Can I tell him? I was saying, Mark's house 2 weeks ago, and I came in looking for some Dharma books, and he moved into the meditation space with Common Ground, and they hadn't had a chance to sort of organize things yet, and I came to Mark and said, Mark, so your bookshelf, you've got Dharma books and worldly books all sort of mixed up. You got Dharma books on the bottom and worldly books up on the top. And so I'm staying in this house now. And Mark, did you notice the bookshelf? He got praise.
Yeah.
blame in the beginning, praise in the end. That's what it's all about. So, yeah, so a shrine should be used just for the aspect of sort of devotional practices. And if, you know, if you have someone who's ill, you know, a friend or a relative, you know, that's sort of you want to keep in your heart for, you know, dedicating merit towards, it's fine that we do occasionally put people, pictures like that up on the shrine. And also too, if you have a teacher that you really feel inspired by, so it's like, it's not uncommon for, like, usually in my shrines I have a picture of Ajahn Chah in the, on my shrine I actually have a painting, a little painting that Wen did, she did, of the sun and the moon. It's really beautiful. Just one circle, but the moon's on one side and the sun's on the other, and it's one face. So it's like the moon is facing in, but the sun's facing out, and it looks like one face. It's really beautiful. A little offering. So some of the things that do mean something personal to you. So it's like, I know John really likes the, you know, superior abbeys and things like that. So having a nice, you know, really beautiful rock or something like that, so it sort of means something or inspires you in some way. You know, it's okay to have things like that on the shrine as well. And some people actually like maybe elaborate, you know, the complicated shrines, and that's fine too. So it's whatever makes your heart feel good when you look at it. My preference is something like this, very, very clean. Any questions about that? Well, I guess one other thing too is if your meditation room is your where you sleep, it's best not to have the shrine at the end of your bed, like when you're sleeping, your feet are facing the shrine. So it's if your room is such that it actually has to be that way, what you can do. But one time I was staying with Yvonne Rand's place, and her husband in particular, got into this saving Buddhist images from in Tibet and things like that, but you could tell were authentic. But they had hundreds of Buddha images in their meditation hall, and Tonka paintings, all like every square inch of covering Buddhism. I was supposed to sleep there, and I'm like, how am I going to sleep with all these images of, you know, telling you to be awake, for one thing? But the Tonkas in particular, you know, Yvonne Rand, you know, so I asked her, where am I supposed to sleep, and where am I supposed to put my feet? And she showed me on the Tonkas, they have, if you have one, you ever notice they have the scroll, the roll, you unroll that, and so then you cover up the Buddha image, and then it's okay to sort of put your feet at it, because you're not pointing it at the image, and then in the morning, roll it back up. So if your room happens to be in a situation where, you know, your feet would be pointing towards the Buddha image, you kind of have a cover over it or something like that that you could do. But ideally it would be, you know, in a different room and, you know, one specifically dedicated towards meditation and devotional practices and chanting, but I know that's not always possible. And it's not in the monastery. I mean, we have our cabin in this one room, so usually like a 10-foot by 10-foot room, and you just sleep with your head facing towards the Buddha. And also we have almond bowls that we eat, the monks, nuns have. And if we're ever traveling and we're someplace where we don't have a shrine, we actually use our almond bowls as our shrine. So we set that up, and that's the thing that we use that. We actually encourage to actually think of the almond bowl as the Buddha's head. We have rules about how to take care of it and where we set it and things like that. So you don't even have putting image, use a bowl. Just any object that sort of, you know, inspires you to maybe not a dollar bill or anything like that. Something that inspires you spiritually. Any questions about the shrine? Yeah.
I'm curious about the end.
Well, that was the sense of morality, sort of someone who's practicing with a very pure heart.
But if one acquires one, does it matter?
What was that?
If one acquires a particular image,
No, no, whatever, yeah, whatever just appeals to you, yeah. Yeah. I usually like, if I do have to burn it, I use the jitnin, like the Japanese, the little smoke of them. And that tends, I don't tend to, what happens if I were like this one, if we were doing the meditation about 10 minutes into it, I'd have, I have this loud sneeze. It happens every single day at the monastery. But if we use the smoke of them, it doesn't. A couple of
things.
Yeah, well, they used to be made out of iron, but now they're made out of steel. So it's in Burma they're made out of black or some sort of
actual stuff.
So no, but there's a few things we're not allowed to use. Certain objects that would basically be like poison to you and things like that. The wooden bowl will it's hard to clean and you get mold, especially living in the tropics. Certain metals will cause, like even iron bowls, you have to, in a particular way, you have to fire them to get them so they don't oxidize them, so they don't poison you. Again, I just think it's up to the individual, so it's like if you feel, drawn towards that, then I think that's fine.
Yeah,
especially
about the teeth thing, because I do have my altar shrine in my bedroom, and I've got a temple, but like, it's like a separate part of my bedroom, and I see that it's literally facing towards it.
Yeah.
And how about
cleaning it? Oh, that's a good question, yeah. Ideally, you would clean it every day. If they get the monastery, after the morning puja, we have about a half hour cleaning period where everybody in the monastery has some sort of task, but it's cleaning the grounds that's around the main shrine area. And one person's job is just replacing the flowers or taking care of that. And then they replace the candles, whenever they need to. And dusting the Buddha image down and dusting the shrine down. It's busy every day. Many monasteries will have a separate sort of just even rag just for the Buddha image. This is like the, you can clean the shrine with one rack, but even just the Buddha image, you have a completely separate one. And the nice thing about that is it's sort of a couple of years ago, about 7 or 8 years ago, I attempted to walk from New Orleans to Canada, and was going to hike up Highway 61. Made it about a quarter of the way, and then got sick, couldn't go any further. But the man that I was walking with, a man named Austin, he said his house was his apartment, which is a complete wreck, except for one area, and that was his shrine. So he's like, no matter how stressful his life got or how much sort of tension there was, he could always just go to the one corner where he had a shrine, and it was always clean, and just sort of uplifted his heart. And so it was nice he had that refuge, because it's just a place to go that for safety. And then it's nice to sort of like every day to clean the Buddha image, because then sort of you're sort of reminding yourself that's what our aspiration is to live our life being awake to what's happening, and just to honor that, to clean that, what our highest aspiration is every day, going back to it, just getting it to clean. So thanks for that question.
Years ago I bought at Target a Buddha like in it, I don't know, that's actually a planter, and it's got such a good growing on it. I bought it because it was something that was serene, but I got one that is actually through your rubber tree finger.
In Thailand, the garden Buddhas, they think it's disrespectful, but it's just not part of their culture. So I think many ties wouldn't actually kind of think of that as sort of disrespectful. But for in the West though, it's just brings people calm, makes people happy.
Even coming to play like this, it was an image to me that was for me.
Yeah.
But I was now thinking. Mm-hmm.
But Westerners, we have a different, aesthetic quality and things like that. Like when I was in Thailand, the image that they used to have of our Western monastery in Thailand is called Wat Pha Namacha. And they had this image in that the head was like really big, and just most of the Westerners just didn't like it. The proportions didn't look right, and it wasn't aesthetically pleasing to like a Westerner. And then somebody offered to gold leaf it. It was just a bronze image, and somebody offered to gold leaf it. And then what they did is they had to paint it with this green paint, this auto body kind of color. Something to allow the gold leaf to stick onto it. It was kind of a similar color to like your skirt there. And it looked like it was made out of stone after they did it. It was like a sort of greenish kind of tinted granite. And like about 70% of the monks just loved it. Because it actually, because somehow making it look stone, it made the proportions look more accurate. But the abbot decided to go ahead and gold leaf it and stuff like that. And at the end, we all kind of realized that was the right thing. Because no matter, even if it looked good to Westerns, it was in Thailand. And the abbot was always going to be asked, why do you have a green Buddha? even though the Westerners would have loved it, it was like, for the culture, it wouldn't have worked. So sometimes, you definitely have to adapt to the situation and the culture and where we're at. So I would say, though, if you did have a Buddha image, it's outdoors and things like that, just taking care of that area. And, if you have a good image, maybe landscape that area a little nicer and things like that. And sometimes you have these little shrines. You can put like a little roof over it and things like that. And that's always really respectful, things like that. So I think it's more, your intention and it's not neglecting it. The one time you will see images in Thailand outside is when they've been broken. So if you have like a concrete one or a wooden one and stuff like that, and then they break, that's the one time in Thailand you will see them outside, the broken images outside, and I think that's respectful. Often in monasteries you'll have a way out in the forest someplace, you'll be sort of going off trail, sort of hiking, and often you'll come to this Buddha graveyard, the Buddhas sort of sitting there, and that's usually what happens when they break. Around one particular spot. Any other questions? Let's go on to. We're going to 3:30. Why don't we take a break right now? We've been going for an hour and 5 minutes. Let's take a. How long?
10 minutes.
Yeah, maybe a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and we'll do bowing and chanting and questions. If you want to, we can bow 3 times to the Buddha image when we leave, and then when we come back in, bow 3 times. That's the etiquette for being in the Dhamma hall.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.